Hi, Ann Arbor AFers. This is co-host Jess Leetaw. The pod team is taking June off for a much-needed break. Council is still going strong, so make sure you pay attention to the A2 Council hashtag on Twitter, Council meeting threads on Facebook in the Ann Arbor Humans Who Won't group, and check Legistar to read the agendas for yourself. Even though we're off, we hope you still keep getting informed and getting involved. In the meantime, we're rerunning some old episodes you've told us you liked, with a little context about where the topic came from. Today's rerun is episode 20, The Master Plan and Zoning. In politics and governance, there are always conspiracy theories about the quote unquote real power behind the power. Dark money, the mayor and his allies, 5G causes autism. Just as a reminder, surprising and or bombastic claims should always be scrutinized closely and fact-checked vigorously. On the other side of the coin, real policy and governance tend to be the most mundane, seemingly boring matters. For example, if you want to get to the heart of a real deep vein of Ann Arbor feeling, talk about trash collection. And one of the biggest not secret secrets is a city's land use affects everything you probably care about locally in one way or another. You care about schools? Land use. Care about sidewalks and bicycle safety? Land use. Think affordable housing and housing affordability matter? Say it with me, Oprah. Land use. I say it's not a secret because there are comprehensive policies around land use and master planning. The processes governing how it gets changed and how those changes get implemented are exhaustively regulated at the city and even state level. But the reason it feels like a secret is that we often aren't even aware that it's a thing until something hurts. Say there's a traffic pinch point, or a proposed development we're unsure about, or a new affordable housing option got shot down again. And by the time it hurts, the reason it was possible in the first place was because of land use decisions that were made years before. Because of its key relationship to many local policies, and because land use related decisions come up at literally every council meeting, Molly, Michelle, and I plan to do this deeper dive from the very beginning of making the pod. And because it's complex, we took a few months to develop the material to try to make the episode about it interesting and hopefully kind of fun. Here, for your re-listening pleasure, is episode 20, Master Plan and Zoning. Hi, and welcome to this episode of Ann Arbor AF, a podcast for folks trying to figure out what's going on in Ann Arbor. We discuss current events in local politics and policy, governance, and other civic good times. I'm Jess Leetaw, and my pronouns are she, her.
I'm Molly Kleinman, and my pronouns are she, her.
And I'm Michelle Hughes, and my pronouns are she, her.
We're your co-hosts to help you get informed and get involved. It's your city. Let's jump in. Today, we're taking a deeper dive into master planning and zoning. We'll be talking recipes, racism, and heists. You know, normal master planning stuff to help you, Ann Arbor, follow along and get involved. Part one, the master plan and zoning, or the destination. I first want to start with a disclaimer that zoning and land use and master planning are really complex sets of legal and financial and moral and environmental and public health considerations. This episode is going to get into all of these issues at the very highest possible level because we want to invite you in and encourage you to ask your own questions without necessarily being the source of all the answers. I want to thank in advance the urban planners who listen to this podcast because I know they're going to be yelling in their heads about the things that we're leaving out. I know, I get it, I hear you. But this isn't about getting a degree, it's about getting involved, and certain aspects of all of these issues are going to get left on the cutting room floor. So if you want to share some things that you wish we'd covered today, please come and find the thread on this episode in the Facebook group, Ann Arbor Humans Who Walk. Having said that, the definition of a master plan, according to the city of Ann Arbor, is that it's composed of documents or elements that cover the city's major geographical areas and its essential citywide facilities. These plans provide a framework for preserving the city's unique character, ensuring its diversity, supporting investment, and promoting desired change. So essentially what it does is capture the reality on the ground and give us a blueprint for change we might like to see in the future. We talk so much about zoning, and I don't think on this podcast we've ever defined it once. So definition number two, what are zones? The nice thing is this is super easy. We've just never done it before. So a zone is an area or piece of land having a particular characteristic, purpose, or use, or is subject to particular restrictions. In Ann Arbor, we have residential, commercial, manufacturing, office, research and industrial, public, recreational, utility, and mixed use zones. As of this recording, Planning Commission and Council are still talking about a potential addition to our zoning designations having to do with transit-oriented zoning. So we may possibly have a new category soon. All right, so we know what a master plan is. It's a set of documents. We know what individual zones are. Essentially, it's like, just a,
Yeah, the thing, we talked about it at a high level, but like, I wanted to talk a little bit about like the zone, the individual zones. Sometimes they'll say like, okay, this has to be residential use, but then it will also get really specific about like, it has to be set back from the road this many feet, and it has to be this many feet high, and it has to be this many feet. So some of those zoning, you know, zones can get super specific about how buildings have to be built. And not just what they're used for. Yeah.
No, that's exactly right. And we'll talk about this now and also a little bit later in the episode. So the anatomy of a zoning ordinance, and a zoning ordinance covers all the zone in the city. And the zoning ordinance is also the backbone of a master plan. Like, this is the legal document. Everything else is aspirational or strategies. You know, this is what we'd like to try to hit. The zoning ordinance is the nuts and bolts of a master plan. So the zoning map establishes what zones are where, and then the zoning ordinance text defines what those uses are, what you just referred to, Michelle, dimensional standards. So setbacks is how far back from a street or a sidewalk a building has to be. Height or floor area ratio refers to how tall a building can be. And in Ann Arbor and most other places, height restrictions are always can't be higher than, not must be this tall to ride. I think it would be cooler if some buildings were more like roller coasters, but that's where we are. And then easements, well, we won't get into easements right now, but setbacks are also from neighboring buildings side to side. So we've got dimensional standards, we've got development standards, which can include signs, lighting, and I will just highlight parking because we've talked about that on this podcast before, and I'm pretty sure we're going to do a whole episode just on the development standards around parking. And then the procedure, so amendments and administration to the zoning ordinance.
You mentioned you mentioned setbacks, talking about the, you know, the distance between one building and another. And it reminded me of like in some like older town blocks, you can actually see like houses that share a wall, or that the walls are exactly abutted to each other. So it looks like one big building, but it's actually a bunch of little buildings and, you know, in a row. And like, you don't really see that kind of thing anymore. And you know, we basically made it illegal to build in that way. Like, occasionally we sometimes will get row houses built, but they're usually all part of the same development, and they'll be like, you know, they won't be like individually owned. They'll be like condos or something like that. But you don't see anymore like people building a development where it's like, here's a house, this land belongs to someone, and it exactly abuts the neighbor's house.
One of my favorite examples of what you're talking about, Michelle. So as a renter in Ann Arbor, I have lived in many different places around the city. And with the exception of my current house, which I love, and I love my neighbor chickens, my favorite place that I lived was Pittsfield Village, which was a community built in 1943. It's between Washtenaw and Packard, behind Arborland on the south side of Washtenaw. And it is so lovely. Like, there are these small, like 700 square foot homes that are homes just directly abutting one another. Right now, it's a condo association, so you can own the individual homes, but they're clustered around green spaces. So everybody kind of has their own private park that they share with 7 or 14 or 20 of their neighbors. It's a really fun place to get out with kids, get out with dogs, get out and look at the sky, and you don't have to mow anything because the association does that, which is fun.
Nice.
Yeah, but like you said, it's not really legal to build that way right now. And right. Achieving a variance for something like that is pretty hard to do.
And I think there's a lot of ways that, you know, our older neighborhoods, and we love them, and we put, you know, historical designations to keep them just the way we are. And it's because, like, we haven't allowed ourselves to build that way anymore. And
that's right.
All of the beloved neighborhoods can't be built now.
I think it's really interesting that there's pretty heavy overlap between what we designate as historical and what we designate as non-conforming, which means like you said, not legal to build now. And there's a reason for both of those. We could do a whole episode on historic preservation and historic districts that I think would be really interesting conversation around sustainability and affordability. But it is interesting that the things we love, we tend not to allow.
But then we complain about boring cookie cutter development when it's the only thing that's allowed.
So why do we have zoning? I did want to just touch on this because some folks, I think, ask a pretty reasonable question, which is, if zoning makes it hard, expensive, and slow to develop, which it does, then why do we have it at all? The reason really originated in public health, maybe public health and safety, if you wanted to stretch it a little bit. But at the end of the 19th, early 20th centuries, cities were starting to develop so quickly and so high that we were starting to see our first like city canyons or concrete canyons where sunlight really wasn't reaching the sidewalk, where natural air was not really getting into the middle of buildings because they were so enormous and for a while so physically dense. So the first zoning designation was passed in DC in 1910, but the better known one was the New York City Zoning Resolution in 1916, which limited the height and bulk of buildings. And it also had regulatory language around the areas of courtyards and other open spaces, regulating the uses of those buildings and how they could be designated, and establishing designating the boundaries for those uses. So New York City was really the first time in the 1910s was really the first time that we saw this. And then the 1910s and 1920s are when zoning ordinances across the country started to proliferate, including in Ann Arbor. We had our first zoning ordinance in 1923. Part of this proliferation was fed by the Federal Mortgage Underwriting Program. I believe this was in 1934. Which encouraged zoning. They were saying that we will approve loans for homes in these zones or homes with designated uses such as XYZ. And again, that was in the 1930s. So at the beginning of the 20th century, I believe 1910 or so, the majority of Americans lived in cities. It's either 1940 or 1960, probably 1960, the majority of Americans lived in suburbs, which was a first in human history. Not that people had always lived in cities, but they'd either lived in farmland or in trading areas. And now we had kind of this third place for people to live, which was not a city, not a farmland, but something that sort of aspired to be both.
It was a desolate wasteland and continues to be.
That's one way to talk about a suburb. And I'm going to say you're not wrong.
It's a place where you can't get anywhere if you're not in a car. It's just, I don't know.
Right. And that's kind of the definition, right? Like the suburb is the point was to be able to need a car or to need a car to get there.
Right.
Well, and I'm going to push back on this a little bit because I come from the coast where there are lots of older suburbs that were built before car dominance was so great. And they were often built around these train lines that would take you into whatever city they were the suburb of.
Oh, okay.
I grew up in a place like that. And it's funny, I think, Jess, you and I had this conversation very early on in our acquaintance where I described Ann Arbor as feeling very suburban. And people take offense when
I got salty about it.
Right. I'm really upset when I say that Ann Arbor feels like the suburbs, because in terms of the layout and the zoning, the extent of these single family household neighborhoods, that's what it looks and feels like to me. Growing up in I grew up in a suburb that was almost twice as dense as Ann Arbor is. It's still definitely a suburb with all of like a lot of those cultural features that we deride about suburbs, but in terms of structure and layout, it was denser than here. And so there is, you know, I just like to push back on that. I think here in Michigan, that's largely true. The suburbs are very car oriented, very sprawly.
That's true. And Molly, I'm going to push back on your pushback and we can go like at this forever. I completely validate your lived experience. And I do not believe that the majority of suburbs in America reflect the experience that you had. I grew up in Atlanta, which is basically all suburb, LA, the Midwest, the Northwest. Like you don't need to be in Michigan, which is very explicitly car oriented, but you don't need to live here to kind of be saturated in the car oriented suburb that are still being built today. Like this is not a relic of the 20th century at all.
Oh, so yeah.
I think it's great that you had a positive experience, but I think that yours is.
I wouldn't go that far. I'm not going to. I wouldn't go that far at all. I think my point was more about like the structure of the physical spaces, and the like there's more than one way to like think about how like what makes a suburb. And I think if you define it purely by its car orientation, you lose a lot of places, not all over the country for sure. I mean, I got out of that suburb. I wanted to live in a city. Mm-hmm. But I often debate how much of a city Ann Arbor is or feels like.
My favorite part about what you're saying, Molly, is that my partner, Jack, describes Ann Arbor as suburban as well. And that made me mad for years until like over breakfast one day, we finally hashed out as a relationship conversation, what does a suburb mean? You know, like normal people do. And Jack grew up like 5 miles from you, Molly.
Right. We grew up in very similar places.
That's right. So yeah. Apparently, like if you were in a very particular part of like the area around Philadelphia, then you have a different construct of suburb than like everybody else.
Right. Well, and I mean, a lot of my family was in New Jersey. New Jersey is the most suburban state in the country, I think, but mm-hmm. it's also the densest.
Mm-hmm.
And so that there's a duality to that. I don't want to live in New Jersey either, probably. Sorry, family, mm-hmm. if you're listening. but anyway, back to Ann Arbor's zoning.
Back to Ann Arbor's zoning.
So actually, since you guys were pushing back on stuff, I wanted to push back on something too. Since
yay!
You talked about the first zoning laws being created around these concrete canyons where there was no access to sunlight and all that. And like, I hear that story a lot when I hear about the creation of zoning. And I also hear that story a lot anytime like someone tries to build a 4-story building in Ann Arbor, like, oh my God, there's going to be no sunlight. There's going to be nothing. So I'm kind of like, it kind of makes me skeptical about the history of it. Like, was it the same type of people who would complain about a 4-story building now just being like a snowflake about,
you know? Right. And that speaks, I think, to a larger issue of how people utilize the language of oppression when really what they're talking about is comfort. Injustice and discomfort are absolutely not the same thing, but especially in places like Ann Arbor, where we are like so proud of how progressive we are, we say things like it's inequitable to have a building this tall when mm-hmm. what we're talking about is 40 feet and not 200 feet or, you know, 800 feet, whatever the super talls are. So Michelle, your question is a good one. And the answer is yes, buildings were killing people. They were fire hazards. They were toxic air hazards. in New York, there were issues around tenements packing people so densely in that if they didn't have access to natural air or sunlight, and that was not mandated for a while. Right now, the definition, one definition of a bedroom is that it has a window. That wasn't true always. And so we were creating genuinely unhealthy, genuinely hazardous environments, both living and working for people. So this originated for good reasons. We are using it now to do a lot of different things.
But I kind of feel like a lot of those type of problems are solved, are better solved by building codes and than zoning codes that directly say like a bedroom has to be this big. It has to have a window. It has to have a fire escape. You know, like that's the kind of thing that you say in the building code, not in the zoning code.
I know. And you're right. And we do have much, much better building codes now than we do than we did this time a century or a century and a half ago. One caution that I'll put on that is that building codes are largely driven by building industry professionals. And so what that means is that we're often hitting minimum standards when it comes to health and safety or not health and safety. Those are actually fairly well established. But when it comes to sustainability for absolute sure. And then for efficiency of achieving a city's larger goals. So if you're trying to achieve density, I'm going to use a metaphor that's a little bit off topic, but it's the one that's coming to mind. If you ask a transportation engineer what a road is for, they will say it's to move as many cars as possible. Right. When if you ask a transit engineer what a road is for, they'll say it's to move as many people as possible. And those two have very different goals and very different strategies. The building code is kind of the same thing. They want to build houses that are, how do I want to say this, good for the building industry, but doesn't necessarily speak to a city's goals. So we probably need the two sets of standards talking to one another. We need urban context and we need good buildings.
Yeah. I mean, that's, I'm just saying like the Triangle Shirtwaist Fire was not, you know, that's not going to be something that's prevented by zoning. That's going to be something that's prevented by building codes.
Building codes and better labor practices.
Correct? Yes.
But there are also, and correct me if I'm wrong, because I'm the real new, like the newbie here when it comes to all of this stuff, but zoning.
No experts at this table, only interested hobbyists.
Zoning also regulates what can be where. And my understanding is that some of that early work was about keeping living spaces away from the really hazardous industrial spaces so that you don't have people breathing like tannery fumes all day or whatever the heavy industry at the time was.
Right. That's correct. So it wasn't just about building form. It was also about beginning to segregate building use. That's exactly right. And for exactly that reason, that's actually an underpinning of part of the 1960s and 1970s sustainability movement, the one that started the phrase, not in my backyard, which right now has a really complicated meaning that I will ask you very nicely to not get into right now. But in the 1960s and 1970s, what they were saying is we do not want toxin producers. It started as around our children's schools, and then around homes, which is where the backyard came from. So what they're saying is we want to live in a neighborhood that's environmentally friendly. How this got mobilized in the service of white supremacy, you know, that's relatively well documented. But NIMBYism started with sustainability goals and was rooted in zoning, specifically in zoning.
Well, sustainability, but also health and safety, right? So like we know for a fact that living in proximity to coal-fired power plants has like produces higher rates of asthma and cancer, like genuine health concerns. And I think one thing that really stands out to me is that we've had zoning for a long time and it's not ever kept these like kinds of poison industries away from all of the people's homes. So like Detroit has major neighborhood issues with, I think there's even incinerators, even now. It never stopped being a problem. And in fact, a lot of times the really industrial uses were put closest to Black neighborhoods.
Black and poor, absolutely. Yeah.
And that's, go ahead.
I kind of feel like you know, another suggestion of mine is that like these type of problems could be solved by stricter environmental standards rather than zoning. Like rather than saying, hey, let's put the toxin spewing factories over there. And why don't we say, hey, let's not have toxin spewing factories. Let's have factories that must deal with their toxins responsibly. And then we don't have toxin spewing factories. And then like, then you can put them right next to, you know, then you can put the jobs right next to the people where the people, you know, live.
That's absolutely right. Michelle, I think that's where we're going. I also think that's part of the urgency that people have around climate, carbon neutrality and climate plans is right now the benchmarks are often set so far in the future, 2035, 2040, 2050. But the urgency is now to get those going because changing over the technology and the training of people who use it is not a small process. And we do need to manage for that time, but we have to start like 50 years ago and failing that we have to start today. Right. So I agree with you. We need great environmental legislation. We need solid building codes and we need good zoning. And we'll talk a little bit in a couple of sections about the future of zoning. But for right now, I just want to close out this section and say that, as I mentioned, Ann Arbor's first zoning ordinance was in 1923. Its first modern zoning ordinance, we would call it, would be like 1963. Our current master plan was implemented in 1998 and updated in 2009 and has a number of other elements and resource documents created over the last 20 years.
Oh, can I ask when you say the first modern zoning code was 1963, what is the feature that like, why is that, what makes that a modern zoning code and why like such a bright line cutoff?
Sure. So that's one of the technical things that is staying on the cutting room floor, but I am happy to put the definition for why that's a cutoff in the show notes. And it's a good question, Michelle. All right. So let's go to part two, master planning the process.
I really hoped that this was going to be about heists. I was imagining like Kate Blanchett in a really good suit, like helping to steal some jewels from the Met Gala.
I gotta say, anytime you say Kate Blanchett in a suit, I start getting some feelings. So, yes.
Don't we all?
I mean, don't we all, right? It's not an inept metaphor because the question of the value of a community, when you're talking financial, the value of community obviously rests in its people and the community that we build together. But when you're talking about the financial value of a community, runaway winners are homeowners, right? Mm-hmm. So especially the less change you make, Michelle, your questions earlier about historical designated neighborhoods and buildings, the less we change, the more the people who were here before or during those changes win, right? Like those are the winners of the system. And the harder it is for new people to buy in, to rent in, to come in. So master planning is a bit of a heist if we don't have a whole bunch of people at the table all stealing the jewels together. I would just like to be Mindy Kaling in that movie, please.
We can steal them from God. Then we can attack and dethrone him.
Yeah, good. I'm glad we're exactly Michelle, on topic.
The attack and dethrone God correspondent.
All right. I like you guys. You're fun co-hosts for this stuff.
Okay, Jess, so what is a master plan actually?
Right.
No jewels involved.
No jewels, only metaphorically. All right. So as a verb, master planning is the community process through which we identify our shared values, our aspirations, our long-term goals, and needed action areas. Master planning is often many, many meetings in many, many different formats with many, many different kinds of stakeholders. And when I say many, I mean hundreds, if not thousands, definitely thousands of stakeholders and typically hundreds and hundreds of meetings over the course of a couple of years to be able to get to a solid master plan. During this process, city staff, the urban systems and transportation planning experts and engineers take that high level guidance from the community back to their digital drawing boards and together with one another, with as you know, technical experts in their field, they create technical planning documents that reflect those goals and then periodically bring them back to the community for review, revision, and approval. So a lot of time you'll see a 2 or a 3-step master planning process where there's a big, just really listening sessions, you know, big town halls, tell us what you want, tell us what you think, tell us what you'd like to see. Then they'll come back with, this is what we hear based on your feedback, help us understand how close we are. People give review, revise, and give feedback on that. And then staff will often bring it back one more time and say, this is what we've heard based on your original input and your feedback. There can be a lot of confusion when people are engaging in a master plan process, what part they're coming in. And what I mean is a lot of folks tend to hear about the end of a master planning process where stuff is maybe 90% baked in and feel like because they're only just now hearing about it, they want to go back to the very beginning and start talking about big goals and, you know, high level values. And everybody else is like, no, we already covered that. So that's definitely a tension in the master planning process. Where Ann Arbor is in this is in 2018, council put out a request for proposals for a team to drive a new 1 to 2 year master planning process, as well as rationalize our existing master planning documents. Right now, we have 8, I believe, master planning documents and 15 to 20 resource documents, which aren't technically part of the master plan, but are used to inform different decisions. And given that many different documents, all of which accomplish individual goals, like the Reimagine Washtenaw Corridor Plan, the transportation plan, the non-motorized transportation plan, the carbon neutrality plan, but that's actually not part of the master plan. These all accomplish valid things, but they don't really talk to one another. And so sometimes their goals or their strategies are in competition with one another and don't play out well, don't play well together. At that time, 2018, as I mentioned, they put out a proposal. Folks responded. Full disclosure, the nonprofit that I run, Building Matters Ann Arbor, was on one of those teams. Council did end up selecting a firm in 2019. Ours wasn't that team, but it was a great team. But they didn't move forward with the project, and then the pandemic hit. So we are now sitting on a 23-year-old master plan that has seen one meaningful update and many, many additional documents in that time. And the state of Michigan mandates updating master plans every 5 years. So
are we gonna get arrested?
Ann Arbor's gonna get let off in cuffs.
There's a state mandate that we're just not following, and I'm confused about that piece.
I mean, you can look at the different elements that we add. There's an argument to be made that those are updates to the master plan. I think that's a little bit like writing a 10-page paper and triple spacing. Like, okay, you hit the requirement, but you're cheating on a technicality. And I feel that's a little bit what we've done. At the same time, we have a pretty lean planning staff, and master planning requires significant staff time. Even if it's they hire out to a consultant, which is likely, that's most what most cities do. They contract out at least part of it. Even with that, it requires significant staff time, and we're just really not staffed for that right now. So yeah, I mean, Ann Arbor's not going to get arrested this time, but it's not great.
I feel like the process you described, you know, it takes, and like we were planning on this process taking 1 to 2 years. If we're mandated to do that every 5 years, then, you know, if we do that, like, we're just going to be constantly master planning, which, hey, maybe not, you know, maybe that's not a bad thing.
Right. And we're going to get into that when we talk about the future. Right. You're exactly right. 1 to 2 years to do the community engagement, maybe 1 to 2 years if you're going long on implementation, and then boom, it's master planning time again. Mm-hmm. But really, is it ever a bad time to listen to your community? Mm-hmm. And especially right now, when we are seeing technology and social change at a rate that is really unprecedented in this culture, shouldn't we be listening faster? Anyway, right. That's going to come more in the future section.
And the thing you were talking about, like, people hear about the process at the end of the process, and mm-hmm. then they come and want to talk about beginning of the process stuff. And mm-hmm. that's like, okay, just wait 23 years until it's your turn again.
That's right. That's right. So with the master plan, what having a master plan means is that we have a guiding vision for various goals that our city wants to accomplish. What a master plan doesn't mean is that we know exactly what should go on every individual piece of land. It's not saying one house should go here and one business should go there. It's saying we're trying to reduce the number of single occupancy vehicles on the road by 2030. What are the various tools and measures that we can use to accomplish a goal like that? The master planning process, Michelle, to your point, why the process is awesome is that it is a deeply community informed, long range vision for the whole city. Like that's great. That's what it's supposed to do. We're supposed to listen to people and we're supposed to think big. But why it's terrible is that it tends to be overrepresented by people who are already overrepresented in the system. Typically white, typically homeowners, typically 40s and older, typically long-term residents. So if you fall into any or multiple of those categories, you're going to, essentially the master plan is a document for you. It disenfranchises residents.
For them to pull a heist.
And,
and they're there to pull a heist on the rest of Ann Arbor.
That's right. So if we could just get more heists going, like it would be better for all of us. Exactly.
But like, if we get everyone involved, then you know it's not just people, it's not the same people pulling a heist on the same people every time.
Mm-hmm. Yep. Okay, so that's zoning and master planning. Any questions before we go on to the future?
Well, one thing I wanted to talk about the the master planning process and the and stuff is like back in 2018 there was a development that you know, a lot of people I was talking to, I was running for city council at the time. A lot of people that I was talking to were pretty mad about the cottages at Barton Green, which was a development that was a by right development. So they were following every zoning ordinance. They weren't asking for any special treatment. They weren't asking for the zoning code to be changed. Or for their zoning designation of that parcel to be changed. They were just saying, hey, you told us you wanted a building that was like this, and we're going to build buildings that are like this. And everyone hated it. and so, you know, when I heard that, I thought, well, you know, why is this what we've asked for then? You know, if they're giving us exactly what we've asked for and we hate it, what we ought to do maybe is like all get together and re-talk about what we want and what we won't hate. And I didn't realize that I was like reinventing the process of master planning.
Congratulations.
But yeah, like that is something that we are doing, but apparently not doing very often. So I look forward to the master planning process for that reason, because I don't want us to hate everything either.
Right. So this is one question that I have about the master plan. So we're legally mandated by the state to have a master plan and to do a master plan, and we're not super following that rule. The master plan is supposed to lay out like our big vision for the city, I think, but to what extent is the master plan binding? Like,
that's a good question. And that was one of the things that I left out, but it's an easy answer. The zoning map. The zoning map is what's binding. Okay. But what the zoning map is a document of what we have. It does not capture where we're going.
Mm-hmm.
So we absolutely must conform to the zoning map that we have, in that I can't put a school on a piece of land that's designated for apartments. But what the zoning map doesn't capture is all the other elements of the master plan. It's kind of the zoning map is the letter and the elements are the spirit of the law.
Okay.
And the elements and the resource documents assist with interpretation. So if we have a potential use that's incompatible with the zoning map, which again, as you're asking, is the thing that we're legally bound to, what we can do is look at our larger master plan documents and understand, is this prospective new use consistent with other goals in the community that perhaps its existing zoning designation doesn't fulfill or doesn't all the way fulfill.
Right. So then we can rezone, and the idea is that we want to be rezoning within the spirit of our goals, but they don't necessarily have to be laid out to the letter in the master plan or the zoning. I mean, I'm thinking right now, right, of the, this is a recent development that we've talked about on the podcast, 2111 Packard.
I was just thinking about that one. Yeah.
The zoning for that parcel was parking, which doesn't really align with any of our current stated goals in terms of climate, in terms of transportation. And so, you know, they rezoned that, and that was okay, right? Like rezoning is allowed, mm-hmm. and the master, but it, yeah, I guess we have to abide by the zoning, but also we can change the zoning if we want to, guided in theory by the master plan. Is that?
Yeah. Okay. Yeah, absolutely. So let's say you are, oh, I knew I was going to bring food into this at some point. We've made it to the food portion of master planning. All right. So let's say you're planning a dinner party and you have your menu all planned out. You're going to make your favorites, the ones that you know are not going to leave you super sweaty from the oven 5 minutes before everybody walks in the door. You're good. And then you find out one of your guests is allergic to a couple of the ingredients that you were planning to use. And you're like, ah, okay, I need to update what I'm making to accommodate the health and safety of my guests. And I like this person, so I plan to not put them into anaphylactic shock. So you update your menu and you're like, okay, I won't put pecans on the pie. I won't stick them into the chicken, whatever it is you do with pecans. I don't know. I just like to eat them at the shell. But you change your menu a little bit because your understanding of the evening has changed a little bit. Zoning is the exact same thing. We've got a menu. That's what our zoning map is. But when we have different guests coming to the table, and the guests can either be literal people like neighbors that we have or could potentially have with new housing, or it could be new ideas, right? Like the carbon neutrality plan, A20, is new as of the last 2 years. We did not have the sustainability framework 3 years ago. We should absolutely be making different decisions based on that framework and based on the information that we have. So yeah, it's okay that things change. You kind of want them to.
Right. I mean, we talk a lot on this show about the ways we want the city to change. And so mm-hmm. I think I'm trying to poke at is sort of like where the boundaries of the flexibility of all of this stuff is. And like,
mm-hmm. Because the time I hear about the master plan most often is when somebody opposes a particular building and they oppose a particular proposed rezoning, mm-hmm. and they'll say, well, that rezoning doesn't fit with the master plan. And so, you know, it's kind of, I kind of feel a tension there, like how strictly, well, first of all, how strictly are we required to stick with the master plan? And then how strictly should we stick with the master plan?
For sure. And, you know, as we've talked about, the master plan is a complicated thing, right? It's the map, it's the other elements of it, it's the resource documents. And so when you say that doesn't conform to the master plan, that's a fairly broad statement when it comes to all of these like large and competing documents. Michelle, you were reading about an area of town not too far from your house, mm-hmm. and you, like, it was hundreds of pages, right? Like, it's a lot. So saying that something is inconsistent with the master plan, in my opinion, is a little bit simplistic. It would be truer if you get at the heart of what the goals of the mm-hmm. different master plan documents are, and then talk about whether a particular development, a particular zoning or rezoning is consistent with those goals. Because that's what a master plan is. Yeah. It's a document of goals.
I found some weird stuff in there. It seemed to vary quite a bit in specificity. Like it would say, like, we want this to be an urban village. We want there to be pedestrian safety. And we want, you know, like we want this to be an attractive area for pedestrians. And I'm like, awesome. And then they're like, also buildings shouldn't be higher than four stories tall. And I'm like, what, where'd you get that from? Like, that's not like a goal. That's something that should be at the level of like the actual zoning ordinance. That's not something we should be saying in the master plan. Like that's not a, that doesn't feel like an overall overarching goal for the city, you know?
Michelle, thank you for prefacing the future section of this
episode. Ah, yes.
All right. So part three, the future. And what I'm advocating is that we change both the process and the destination. Post-World War II, almost all zoning ordinances require all of the following: minimum lot sizes, maximum heights, maximum densities, minimum parking and loading areas, and minimum landscaping. And what this means is that we're asking property owners to use as much land as humanly possible, and we're asking each parcel to use up as much of the city as possible, which is pretty much counter to almost every goal that we have. Using zoning and the master plan process, the master planning process, to achieve affordability, sustainability, and justice goals means that we're trying to make 21st century decisions on a framework that's reacting against 19th century problems using a 20th century mindset. Like, we're not solving the right problems or using the right tools. What I'm advocating is that we need more modest but more continuous community engagement, and to expect less out of each individual development, but look for more of it overall.
When you say development here, you don't mean changes to the zoning, to the master planning process. You're talking about buildings being built, right?
Changes on individual parcels, right? Yeah. So typically not brand new buildings, but typically changes to the buildings mm-hmm. that we have, an evolution either larger or smaller.
And we should expect less. We should expect each building. We shouldn't expect each building to solve all of our problems, but we should expect there to be more changes around us.
That's right. So for example, let's go back to the transit-oriented zoning that we had talked about a little bit ago. The transit-oriented zoning is attempting to accomplish a lot of goals, but essentially what it boils down to is allowing mixed uses, which is to say office, commercial, and residential space on our transit-heavy corridors. And we all know what those are. It's Plymouth, it's Maple, it's Packard, it's maybe or maybe not industrial, it's Eisenhower, Washtenaw. It's Jackson, it's Washtenaw, thank you. It's the car heavy roads. And what we're trying to do is make it easier to live and work and shop all in the same place. What the transit oriented zoning originally contemplated was mandating all of those uses on each parcel. Mm. And the problem with that is that some parcels are as big as a McDonald's and some parcels are as big as a strip mall. So if you're asking a McDonald's to redevelop and have office and commercial and residential space, and it only gets to be, you know, however many feet tall, from a developer's standpoint, there's no way that pencils out, because either you only get one or two residential units on there that are so insanely expensive, nobody's ever going to pay for them, or they're tiny. And most folks don't want, like, you don't want to incentivize only micro apartments. It's nice in a mix of uses, but not only. So, whereas if you're looking at a strip mall, sorry, Molly, let me just finish the sentence and then I'll take a breath. Whereas if you're looking at a strip mall, it's much more natural for something that's at that scale to house a multiplicity of uses. So what we need our transit-oriented zoning to do is ask for impact in context. We do want housing and commercial and office space all along these corridors, but we don't need every single parcel to accomplish every single one.
You used a phrase that I hear people talk about that I had never heard in this context exactly, which is this phrase, does it pencil?
Oh, yes.
Or it doesn't pencil. Can you just briefly explain that one?
Yeah, definitely. So when it comes to development, as with any business proposition, the question is, does this make business sense to me or does it not? When it comes to opening a new business, if you've got a business, I'm going to introduce a new sandwich or a new t-shirt or a new, you know, gadget. You do the math first to understand, are there people that will buy my gadgets? And can I produce them at a cost that people will buy them at? Development is the exact same thing. And that comes into play with zoning, because the property or the buildings that folks own, those uses are restricted by zoning. So the question is, can I create a new thing or can I modify the thing that I have in a way that people will pay for? If it's office space, can I create something at a price point that folks can afford? If it's residential, can I create new houses or new apartments at a price point that's consistent with this market? Ann Arbor is not going to get the same rental prices as Kalamazoo, as Indianapolis, as Atlanta, where I'm from. Like, every market is a little bit different. And so when we're asking, does it pencil? It's a shorthand for, does it make business sense to make this change?
Right. And
but now I want to talk about buildings as gadgets.
So, but then there's also something that it sounds like we've done in parts of Ann Arbor is that we've got so many rules that it become that nothing will pencil it, like in some parts of the city.
We ask a lot of each development, just like you were talking about before, like we need them to, we ask each development to be affordable and have a, and be sustainable and be this and be that. And we put so many.
Ann Arbor is known in the development and building community as having the Ann Arbor factor. And it's two things. One, very dense, very long, very risky process. And two, high land prices. There are other places like Detroit who typically have lower land prices that even if they've got exactly the same development process, different things tend to pencil in Detroit that don't pencil here. It's faster, easier, and cheaper to develop housing in Detroit than it is here because price per square foot or price per acre is vastly different. Or there are places where land is just as expensive, but folks have expedited the process. Seattle is one of those places. And I know that we have like this cultural knowledge that Seattle is expensive. Rents are falling. Rents have started falling in Seattle. And part of that is an expedited development process. Not that anyone can build anything anywhere, but that within the rules of their zoning and their master plan, individual developments are expedited and not submitted to quite as much community scrutiny because they've already done that at the high level. And so it's cheaper to produce individual projects. So Ann Arbor suffers from that 1-2 of tough process, very expensive land.
Got it. Thank
you. Y'all are talking about all my favorite things. No, it's good. It's good. So one of the things that I wanted to talk about as a potential future for Ann Arbor is some municipalities are trying form-based code. What this means is that instead of segregating individual pieces of land, streets, neighborhoods, or parts of town by zone, the goal is to recreate the walkable mixed-use neighborhoods that were the norm pre-automobile by placing an emphasis on the form of a building or street instead of its use. So Michelle, to your kind of tension earlier about this is a goal that we want to have, and this is what the building should look like. That's true, but the third tension on top of that is that this is the goal, this is what it should look like, and this is what the building should do. What form-based code takes out is us telling it the building what it should do, which means we're going to have a lot more percolation of houses and businesses and shops mixed together, where right now they're fairly clearly delineated.
Yeah, I think that, you know, we see a lot of old, like, there's like old neighborhood businesses that are like mixed in with the neighborhood. And I think, you know, people get excited when there's like ways that you can run businesses out of your home. It's a great way to like incubate it. So you don't have to like, you know, if you're just starting out, you just have an idea for a business and you don't think it's, you're not ready yet to go and like rent a commercial space downtown. You could be, you know, the barber of your neighborhood and everyone comes to you kind of thing or something, mm-hmm. you know, just something like that. And that's kind of, it's something that people used to be able to do, but they can't anymore because we told them not to.
That's true. That's true. You know, we talked about it with housing and neighborhoods, but it's true with businesses too, that the mm-hmm. stuff that we love, that we say we love are illegal. Mm-hmm. Jefferson Market, Knights, mm-hmm. Is it Big City, Small World, or Big City, World, Small City? World? Oh, Big City, awesome. I always get it backwards, so I assume mm-hmm. I did it that time too. But stuff like that, you cannot do that now. It's absolutely mm-hmm. illegal. And so to your point, Michelle, we're going to talk about how to queer zoning in a minute, which I'm super excited about. But when it comes to form-based code, I'm going to drop a couple of links in the show notes going into more detail about what it is. because there's a lot to say about it. And it's a potentially really exciting opportunity for Ann Arbor. One is a link to a Strong Towns article that's quite readable. And the other one is a white paper out of East Lansing with specific examples around form-based zoning in Michigan that include Beverly Hills and Grand Rapids, what it looks like, how it's been implemented, what it's doing.
Did you say Beverly Hills? There's a Beverly Hills in Michigan?
100% Beverly Hills. And that's why I said it, because I thought it was funny.
I had no idea.
And the other thing, the last thing that I wanted to say that would take the pressure off of big D development is to use pink zoning, which is a term popularized by the former planning director of Detroit, Maurice Cox. He has since moved on to Chicago and I in the city miss him. But when he was talking about pink zoning, I wish he meant queering zoning. And in my head, that's what it means. But what Maurice was describing was a series of strategies designed to reduce the red tape that right now it takes to create small businesses and develop small properties. What it would take for Ann Arbor to get cheaper and more agile is for us to think a lot smaller rather than a lot bigger about the changes that we're trying to make and allow weird, new, cool stuff that right now we say with our zoning and our master plan, we don't want. Mm-hmm. So, part four, get informed and you can't get involved, but we'll get you involved anyway. So there's a lot when it comes to the master plan to get informed on. And a great place to start is just with Ann Arbor's master plan documents. We'll drop a link in the show notes for all of the master plan documents. Read as much as you can handle, or at least skim the ones that seem interesting and relevant to you. There is probably a master plan element pertaining to your area of the city. If you care about transportation, that's in there. The tree line master plan is in there. There's a ton of resource documents in there pertaining to sustainability and the downtown and other parts of the city. So there's probably something in there that will pique at least one point of curiosity, if not two or three. The other thing that you can do but listen out for, that you can't do right now but listen out for, because there's not currently a master planning process underway, there's nothing to get involved with there, but there are often smaller engagements. So keep an eye out for City of Ann Arbor surveys and community meetings, and get in touch with your council members and ask them to inform you when master planning does get going. They're absolutely going to want more people and more kinds of people involved in these conversations. And you're one of those.
They're going to want that. And I'm going to want that too. I want this to be not a heist.
Not a heist. Or at least all of us walk away with all the crown jewels. Right. Absolutely. Something that's helpful in, I was thinking a lot when preparing for this episode of many years ago, me, who was really daunted by public meetings and never felt like I knew enough to be able to speak in these. So if I'm describing you, please come to the meetings. You're the one we want. And if I'm not describing you, find somebody who qualifies, who feels really uncertain and maybe a little bit scared about conversations like this, and bring them along with you. Absolutely, every public conversation is a place to take space for your thoughts and feelings, but it's also an opportunity to make space for others who have often not been heard in these processes. So speak up, but listen for who we're not hearing and help them have a place at the table too. So, that's all the parts. There's no more parts.
Well, I have more questions.
Oh, good.
One thing that I hear a lot, both in the national conversation around zoning and also locally, is this idea of banning single family zoning. And it seems as though it gets fear-mongered as people want to ban single family houses, which I don't think anyone's talking about ripping down all of the houses. It's more about banning single family zonings. And so I'm curious if you could talk a little bit more about what that means. And then also, it sounds like maybe there's some opportunities specifically around that piece of zoning that might be coming up in Ann Arbor sooner.
Yeah, that's a great question. Thanks, Molly. when there are a lot of examples of cities around the country examining their single family zoning. And let me talk, I like to start with definitions so we all know what we're talking about. So single family zoning is a residential zoning where only one family is permitted to live on that property. There are a lot of asterisks and other possibilities.
Who gets to decide what a family is?
Who? That's right. That's an active conversation. And honestly, Colorado a year or two ago had a fantastic conversation that ended with, I think, statewide legislation saying that for you to have any conversation around what a family is means that you are talking about blood and emotional matters that the state has no business interfering with. And so Colorado totally backed out of definition of families, which I think is rad and everybody should do.
Everyone should do that.
In Ann Arbor, we have three levels of zoning class, residential zoning classification, and within those, multiple different designations, but essentially three levels. So there's R1, which is single family. There's R2, which is essentially duplex. And then there's R4, which is usually what we call multifamily, which is, I can't remember if it's three or more units, four or more units, or six or more units. But typically, if you think about apartments, it's R4. The challenge with residential zoning is that it's incredibly restrictive and also incredibly proliferative. Like, it's all over the city. We've got more land besides public land, and that's specifically because of roads and the university, really. Single family zoning takes up more land than any other zoning designation in the city. But there's only one use that can go there. And when folks talk about banning single family zoning, what they're saying is let's allow two or more, a duplex or more. In Minneapolis, the master plan update that they just did starts with a floor of four or more that's mandated by the zoning. It's not saying you can't develop single family homes. It's not restricting. What it's doing is allowing more different types of housing. So R1, R2, and R4 would be allowed in all residential zones if single family zoning were eliminated. Does that answer it?
I think so.
So it's okay. Like saying you can't require a single family home to be built, but.
That's right. But you can allow it.
You can, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Whereas right now we require it in okay. most residential areas of the city. Okay. Where Ann Arbor is in this process is that, as our longtime listeners will know, we are in the middle of budget season at the city, and the city planning department has requested a budget allocation for doing research and community engagement around single family zoning in the city of Ann Arbor. So we can expect some community engagement around that between this and next summer. I will say it's not really possible to look at the historical roots of single family zoning and not talk about white supremacy and the racist origins of zoning. Like, you cannot separate the two. That's where it started. So it's helpful to understand that when we talk about banning single family zoning, a lot of communities, when they do that, it's as a restorative justice measure correcting against historical decisions that we've made.
So Jess, tell us a little bit more about why it's racist.
That's a good question. And I'm also going to drop a link in the show notes to the book, The Color of Law, which goes into more detail about this. Essentially,
for your listeners, I just wanted to tell you that Jess picked up the book and showed it to the camera. So
it's always handy, but for this episode, it was handier. It's like, it's my moral support for this episode. Yeah. The Color of Law. Mm-hmm. I'm a little bit choked up because I'm trying to say 17 different things about housing right now. Where American housing in the 20th century kind of evolved through was, where can we get away with racism? So before 18 or 19, the answer was everywhere. And then in 1918 or 19, they banned, I'm going to get my history mixed up a little bit because you've asked me and my brain's all excited, but they banned saying that individual races couldn't live in specific areas of a city. But this was 1928, actually. This was a Supreme Court ruling in 1928 saying that a city couldn't say that people of specific races, ethnicities, or religion couldn't live in specific areas of cities. So, but what they didn't say, or rather what they did say, is, but we're not going to touch private transactions. And what that meant was racially restrictive covenants went into force really all over the country. And here in Ann Arbor, our first recorded ones were in the 1910s or the 1920s. So a private seller to a private buyer says, I will only sell this to you if you promise that no person of color, typically Black people, but sometimes Jewish people, sometimes Italian people, sometimes people of other races were named, but almost always Black people, don't live here unless they are domestic servants. Those were allowable until the late 1940s. And in the late 1940s, if you remember, this is really when, between the 20s and the 40s, is really when zoning kind of kicked into gear. What zoning, so in the late 1940s, racially restrictive covenants, they were what's called vacated by the Supreme Court. So they were essentially unenforceable, but people were still like creating and selling on them. And there was a lot of like winking and, you know, good old boy elbow nudging and, you know, oh yeah, this is illegal, but really no, don't sell this to Black folks. When zoning ordinances really went into force, by that time they were codifying racist housing practices that had been in practice in the country for almost half a century. And what it was saying is that, okay, whoever lives here now, this is who gets to live here. So if you were able to buy a single family's home before the 1960s, then that's who gets to live in this neighborhood. Now that's absolutely expanded. There were civil rights legislation in the 1960s that really took a lot of these limitations off. There was a lot of legislation that took the laws off the books, but we still have a lot of information that's as current as this year about unfair mortgage lending practices, about unfair realtor home showing practices, about unfair inspections, unfair housing assessments, where Black folks are penalized across the board financially or access wise.
And also, like, you know, even if we take the laws off the books, even if we were able to stop getting people to behave badly, we haven't done anything to actively reintegrate these neighborhoods.
Exactly right.
And also, like, I also wanted to mention the Federal Housing Administration's original policy of giving loans to people to buy houses, but then they would only give those loans to white people. And that was their official policy for a while. And I don't know the dates of that, but and so, like, you know, the initial big housing boom of single family homes, like, was basically only available to white people.
That's right. And that's 1930s and 1940s when that really started picking up the pace. Mm-hmm. And by the time those laws were outlawed is exactly when what we interpret as our modern zoning ordinances started being enforced. So it's a troubling but very clear progression. And it's one of the reasons why we need to look the history of our zoning policy in the eye. It sounds like a boring, eye-glazy thing to say, but if you care about justice, it is a critical component of it. Mm-hmm. And that's all I have to say about that.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Well,
thanks, you guys. That was a fun conversation. Yeah. We covered a lot of ground.
Excellent.
Zoned interesting.
So, Molly, you want to do some pod keeping for us?
Oh, right. So, yes. As always, we wanted to thank everyone who has supported us through the Ko-fi. We have our website now, which is supported by all of you. You can find us at annarboraf.com. And if you'd like to send us a few dollars to cover these hosting fees, you can find us at ko-fi.com/annarboraf.
And that's it for this episode of Ann Arbor AF. We're your co-hosts, Molly Kleinman, Jess Lita, and myself, Michelle Hughes. And as always, thanks to our producer, Jared Malestein. For questions about this podcast or ideas for future episodes, you can email us at annarboraf@gmail.com. Get informed and get involved. It's your city. And we have, our theme music is I Don't Know by Grapes. And we've got some good links in the show notes. So check those out and get involved.